83. Right now, humidity high at 87%. It's overcast, 71 degrees Kenosha, 69 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. The first is with the author of a very important new book about homelessness in America. What are its root causes, and what can we do to address this? Part two is an archival interview from 2016 with acclaimed British novelist James Swallow, talking about his thriller titled Nomad. Here's part one of today's program. We will spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about homelessness. It is a serious problem here and across the country, and it is a problem that has a very intriguing and indeed, I would say, frustrating history. And for every advancement, when it comes to this problem, it seems like we take one or two steps back. And there is a tug of war that is at play in terms of us coming to an understanding of what homelessness is, its most fundamental causes, and especially a difference of opinion, perhaps, when it comes to how we should view the right to have a home, the right to have shelter, and whether or not we can and should regard that as a fundamental human right. Well, that is certainly the opinion of my morning show guest, Maria Foscarinas, who has worked tirelessly on behalf of the homeless and on behalf of this cause as an attorney and a very hardworking activist, at one point with the National Coalition for the Homeless, later for the National Homelessness Law Center, and she is the author of a very important new book called And Housing for All, The Fight to End Homelessness in America, published by Prometheus Books. It is a book that has left me, in a sense, deeply shaken, even shamed by what we have allowed to occur over the last few decades. And it is also at least some cause for hope, knowing that there are people working so hard on behalf of the homeless and trying to end homelessness as we know it. Maria Foscarinas, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Happy to be here.
One of the most important things that you say in your book is that homelessness, as we are experiencing it now in such widespread fashion, is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, there have always been some homeless among us, but actually we can point to the early 1980s to when the problem of homelessness proliferated and in your words, becoming a seemingly permanent feature of American life. Remind our listeners about what occurred in the early 1980s that led to this disturbing explosion in homelessness.
So the trigger in the early 1980s was the advent of the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan came into office on a promise to shrink the federal government. He viewed government as the problem, not the solution. So starting in 1981, he instigated major cuts to social safety net programs, really slashing them, and housing took a huge hit. So housing programs took were cut by over 50%. And to give you a sense of what this means, in 1979, over 300,000 new units of affordable housing were funded by the federal government. 3 years later, 1982, under 3,000 new units were funded. So these are huge cuts that were put in place through thanks to President Reagan. And at the same time, other social safety net programs were cut. So this threw a huge number of people into homelessness. The groundwork had already been laid in the 70s with the loss of inexpensive housing in the private housing market. But really the trigger was these cuts in the early 1980s. And that's, in fact, when we see homelessness exploding around the country. It shifted from being a limited problem affecting a limited group of people primarily in urban centers, skid rows, to being a problem affecting a broad swath of the population, especially families, children, working men and women, and all over the country. So not just urban areas, but also suburban and rural parts of the country.
I want to be sure to not let another second go by without saying that one of the things I really appreciate about your book is that although you write this as an attorney, well acquainted with the systemic problems in place that have both caused and exacerbated homelessness in our country, this is also a deeply personal book in that as you are talking about matters related to public policy and so on, you also take the time to tell us the story of real people with real names who, for one reason or another, have been or currently are homeless. And I want to say that I'm not always a fan of books that are written in that fashion, because I think it can be a very, very tricky matter, that sometimes those personal stories, while they are deeply moving, can also kind of get in the way of you know, maybe the main point or the objective conversation that is going on. But I can't imagine writing about this important topic in any other way. And I think you really do a beautiful job of weaving these deeply personal stories of real people into this other fabric in which you are talking about policy and so on. I just wanted to say that for the record, that I think it is one of the most compelling aspects of this really excellent book.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate that. And you're right, I struggled a bit with that, because sometimes when you focus on personal stories, you lose the point that this is not really a personal problem. And there's a strong narrative out there that says that homelessness is a personal problem, that blames people for becoming homeless, blames their own personal situations. No, this is a systemic problem, but it affects real people. And I think it's really important to get that balance, that there are systemic policy issues and policy decisions that have been made, but they have an impact on real people. We need to hear the voices of those people who are affected. So I'm glad you think I got it at least a little bit right.
You absolutely did. Another thing I want to be sure to say about your book is that although a couple of minutes ago you made sort of a statement of stinging indictment against President Ronald Reagan and many of his policies that in your view and in the view of many, really started all of this, his policies that, in your words, his massive cuts that shredded the social safety net and really caused the problem of homelessness to become far more serious. But I want to make sure that our listeners understand that when we read your book cover to cover, you are not cautious in criticizing certain Democratic presidents as well. I mean, specifically, President Bill Clinton and President Barack Obama. You criticize really every administration, and including them. And also through the course of your book, you touch on the fact that this is not just something that is happening in, for instance, red districts across the country, but in blue districts across the country as well. That when it comes to responsibility, when it comes to blame, there is a lot to go around, and on both sides of the political aisle, it would seem.
Yes, that's true. And I think it really gets to the point about the role of money in all of this, and that no one is immune to that. It's really pervaded our political system and our society. And a key point I make in the book is that even though housing is a basic human need, we all as human beings need a safe, stable place to live, an affordable place to live. Even though we have that human need, housing has now become a commodity. It's something up for grabs. It's used as a vehicle for profit. And that has been the case across federal administrations. And it's been, so I start with Reagan. Reagan initiates these massive cuts and also this narrative that government is somehow bad. That gets carried through. Bill Clinton campaigned on a promise to end welfare as we know it. He famously talked about welfare queens taking advantage of the system. He continued that narrative. He repealed social safety net programs, in particular programs for poor families. So he continued down the same road. Now, President Obama, even though he had he did good things. I don't want to be totally negative, but it was on his watch that housing was further deregulated, that financial markets became even more involved. So following the foreclosure crisis, his administration helped loosen regulations on that allowed private equity to snap up foreclosed homes and turn them into these profit-motivated vehicles. So private equity has now become an important player in the housing market. So they buy homes and rent them, or they buy homes and try to make a profit from them, and that drives up rents. It makes housing more expensive, and it furthers this idea of housing as a commodity, as an investment vehicle. So, yes, I think that these have been trends that have been accelerating, and they are trends that are not unique to one particular party. Mm. And now there's also this trend of criminalizing homelessness, and that's a trend that's also bipartisan. Both sides of the aisle have embraced to a large extent this idea that people who are living outside, who have become homeless, who have no other place to go because there's a shortage even of emergency shelter across the country, that they should be punished for having no place to go.
Mm. You point out some really interesting and frankly, really disturbing examples of such, I guess we would call them vagrancy laws. And at the outset of this discussion, you remind us that there have been all kinds of laws like this through much of human history. So this phenomenon is not brand new. But the way in which many of these vagrancy laws and policies have been crafted in recent years, to the point of in some cases of making a camping on public property a felony. I mean, this is something that we have not seen before. And of course, as your book so vividly describes, this puts the homeless in an all but impossible situation.
Exactly. Terrible trend that has been accelerating since the 1990s, and it's now gotten much worse. Last year, there was an important Supreme Court decision that opened the floodgates, really. It removed an important argument we had been, and other advocates had been making against these laws. And since then, there's just been an even greater proliferation of these types of laws that make it a crime to be without a place to live. And it is an impossible situation. There is literally no place for people to go. This is bound to get worse with this current administration, which has really embraced this idea. And it's absolutely not the way to go. This is not just cruel, it's also ineffective. Obviously, people have to be somewhere, and making it a crime to be in public is not going to do anything to solve the problem. It will just make it worse. Imagine trying to get a job or find housing with an arrest record. That's just even harder.
Right. And of course, that's as we hear the stories of some of these real people, and in some cases, real families, parents with children who are experiencing this. One of the things you describe so vividly is that whole thing that we sometimes sort of casually refer to as, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Figuring it out, nose to the grindstone, get it done. It is all but impossible in some cases to do this because of this reality of having no place to live, having no place to shower, having no permanent address. And in many cases with curfews, taking your family to a shelter might have to occur while you're supposed to still be washing dishes in the local restaurant, and so you lose your job. It is a vicious cycle. And even if all of these individual pieces were not consciously put in place to cause this, to cause this misery, the cumulative effect is exactly that. And that is what needs to be remedied somehow. I think that's the heart of your book.
Exactly. But it's also true that these are deliberate decisions. And it may be that they didn't start out with the goal of tormenting people, and that they probably are still not being put in place with that goal. But that is the effect, and it's obvious that will be the effect. And there's no reason for these policies. Really, it makes no sense that in a country that has the wealth that this country has, that people don't have the basics they need to survive, and that on top of this, they're being punished for that, for being in that situation.
Right.
It makes absolutely no sense. And it's also costly. It would be far more cost effective to actually make sure that people are housed than to spend money, to spend taxpayer resources to punish people. These are police resources, they're jails, they're prosecutors. Makes no sense. Police officers themselves know that makes no sense for them to be spending their time chasing people who have no other alternative. So these are senseless policies that are cruel and counterproductive.
To return to President Reagan for a moment, one of the things you remind us is that as discussions were taking place at that time with increasing numbers of the homeless population, it was President Reagan who said that those who are continuously living on the street are, in his words, homeless by choice. That, you know, somehow these are people who are so disturbed or so mentally or emotionally deficient or for whatever reason, just cannot function in so-called proper society, and so this is where they are, but essentially by their own choice. And you call this a fiction that still finds resonance today. That's really scary to think about some of those statements made all those decades before that continue to frame this narrative for a whole lot of people.
Right. It's true that, you know, Reagan did say those people are homeless by choice, and it's something that is still repeated to this day by Democrats and Republicans alike. And, you know, look at Governor Newsom in California, who is going down exactly this path, and he's doing it by saying we're actually helping people get the help they need. That those, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of what he's saying, is if people are somehow out there because they don't know any better or they need to be prodded and pushed into getting help, the help doesn't exist. Everybody knows this. You can. This is a matter of numbers. We know there's not even enough emergency shelter. There's certainly not enough housing for people who need mental health care. Some people do. It's the minority, not the majority of people. But we know they're not mental health resources. For people who need help with substance abuse, we know those resources aren't there. So, you know, people are not out there because they have made a decision they like to be living on the street. They're out there because they have no choice. And for everybody who's visibly homeless, who's out on the street, there are many, many more people who are not visible, who are couch surfing, who are living in their cars, who are doubling up with friends and relatives, sleeping on someone's floor. Those are much larger numbers, and for those people, there are also all of the other people who are living from paycheck to paycheck, which is a huge number of people. 60% of the population, by some counts, are paycheck to paycheck, and any unexpected expense could throw them into down a path of homelessness where they lose their home, they get evicted, and then they're scrambling. So these are not personal problems that you can say people choose. These are policy choices that we make, that our society has made.
I want to say again that you are an attorney, and you have worked on this issue for years as an attorney, and I think you do a really good job of describing sort of the legal intricacies that are involved in some of these landmark cases. And in some cases, we're talking about court cases that we perhaps have never heard of, but they are examples of how this fight is being played out in courtrooms across the country. There's an especially interesting case you talk about in very recent years. It was Johnson versus Grants Pass, and right. Which ultimately ended up at the U.S. Supreme Court, as I think you've already touched on. But the fact that in this court case, arguments were being made in terms of, well, it's okay to sleep outside, but just don't have a blanket around you, or don't be under a cardboard box. I mean, the things that are sort of visible signs that this is a homeless person. I mean, when this becomes that kind of legal fight, it has to be truly dispiriting to think that people are making such arguments in a courtroom.
Exactly. Yes, it really is. And in a way, it's symptomatic of the fact that our legal system has not recognized basic rights like the right to housing. And so we end up making these arguments that are increasingly kind of around the edges of the real issues, like the arguments over whether people should be criminally punished for being outside, whether it makes a difference if they have a blanket or a box or they're just there sleeping out there. When judges strike down these kinds of laws, they don't have an option to require affirmative remedies, to require cities to provide housing. Usually they don't have that option. That's because we have not embedded the right to housing in our legal system. If we had that, the responses would be much more straightforward. Right. We could say, no, don't criminally punish this person. Offer them housing instead.
Hmm. Towards this fundamental right to housing, you explained that the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision basically preserved some of these city laws because they were dealing with a person's actions. I mean, that is what's being punished, a person's action. A person is not being punished for the status of being homeless, but for the action of sleeping on a park bench or whatever it might be. And what you are saying is that we cannot make that distinction, that everybody has the right, the need to sleep, and they have to sleep somewhere. And so this is a dramatic reframing of this understanding that you are calling us to embrace. And you point to statistics that show that actually a majority of Americans have at least some sympathy and understanding of this understanding of housing being a fundamental human right. But where do we go from here to implement that in a more profound way?
Well, implementing it is going to require a lot of people coming together and making that demand, and alliances and coalitions built across issues. We've got to understand that homelessness is the tip of a big, much bigger iceberg, and it's an iceberg that relates to extreme poverty and inequality, which we're now experiencing in an unprecedented way in our country. So groups, as more and more people are actually touched by the crisis in affordable housing, I think this is possible. I think it's possible for people to come together and demand change on this issue.
Right. I mean, one of the things you say is homelessness is not a disease nor an accident. It is the result of deliberate policy choices made by people. And of course, if that's true, then other policies can be put in place. And you also say in your fine book, this is not a matter of charity, it's a matter of justice. The book is And Housing for All, The Fight to End Homelessness in America, published by Prometheus Books, the author Maria Foscarinas. Maria Foscarinas, thank you for your dedicated work on behalf of this important issue, and thank you for writing this remarkable book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was privileged to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate your inviting me.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We shift gears for part two of today's program, bringing you an interview from the Morning Show archives recorded and initially broadcast back in 2016. And I am very, very privileged indeed to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking with one of the great master authors when it comes to the thriller. Actually, James Swallow is a gifted writer who has written in a number of different genres, a best-selling author of nearly 40 novels, and he is highly regarded, highly decorated in his native Britain, and is also someone who has done a great deal of screenwriting as well. His latest book, at least the latest book to reach print here in the United States, is a thriller titled Nomad. And I am very, very excited to be able to speak with him about this book, which is now released here in Forge. I believe it was released in Britain a couple of years ago to tremendous acclaim. James Swallow, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Greg. And I have to say, spare my blushes there. That was a glowing introduction. Thank you very much.
Well deserved. Your career, as I've just touched on, is actually wide-ranging one, and I'm especially intrigued by the fact that your many credits include quite a bit of screenwriting. I wonder to what extent you think that your rich experience as a screenwriter is a significant factor or influence in how you write a novel like Nomad. How are those two exploits different, and how are they also related to one another?
I would say I think the connection is very strong. I mean, at the end of the day, writing is writing, of course, you know, so I think it's the source that the inspiration for creating a script or a piece of prose still comes from the same place, comes from the same wellspring. But I think having the visual sense that screenwriting requires does translate well, especially to the thriller genre, because that's a very fast-paced, propulsive style of storytelling. And I think if you have a strong visual style, that translates well to the idea of an action story on the page in prose form.
I saw you comment in an interview about the amount of detail that belongs in a book like this, and for that matter, I suppose any writer writing anything has to think a bit about the level of detail or amount of detail. And you said in this interview, "I like fictional worlds that are rich in detail, but not bogged down by it." I think that's such an intriguing concept, the notion that that sometimes more is too much, and that the level of detail could actually get in the way of even more important matters. Can you talk about what you think about in terms of that level of detail that you give to any piece of writing, but particularly when you are writing some of your exciting novels?
When I think of detail, there's a phrase that comes out that I think sums it up nicely, and that's granularity. If you can have a level of detail where you don't have to be describing every single object and the color of everybody's clothes and every single smell and scent, but if you can create a sense of the granularness of the real world, because that's the thing that we notice every day. You know, when you look around the room, you see objects and you have a sense of the fineness of the small details. And I think if you can sell the reader on the idea of that granularity in a story, so perhaps you give them a specific description of a particular object or an odor or a sense that is redolent of that location, I think that's the key to selling your reader on the idea that they're in a certain place, that they're experiencing a certain kind of thing. Part of the thing that happens as a writer is, you know, we research our stuff to try and make it feel realistic and truthful, and there can be a tendency that once you've done that research, you want to put it all on the page. And, you know, you can kind of get bogged down, you can find yourself getting right into the weeds and putting in detail that perhaps you, as the writer, thinks is really great, but perhaps the reader might find slows things down a little bit. So it's finding that ideal balance between, you know, too much and just quite enough. Mm.
I want to take just a second before we get to the novel Nomad. That is our primary reason for speaking today. But as someone who happens to be a big Star Trek fan, I just have to take a moment to ask you about one facet of your career in which you write the so-called tie-in novels that fit into a wide legacy of a franchise like Star Trek or Doctor Who or the television series 24, or I think there are actually examples even beyond that. What is especially maybe pleasurable and fun and also challenging about penning a novel that needs to fit within a universe or a context that already exists, already created by somebody else, in terms of bringing to it your own voice, your own sensibility, and yet creating a work that doesn't seem jarring and out of place within a context that its fans are very familiar with and very much devoted to?
I mean, I equate it quite often to the work that a TV writer would do if they were brought on to a television series that had been going on for quite a while. You know, you have to come in and you have to have this understanding that there is a weight of expectation from the fan base, that people know these characters and they're intimately familiar with them. And obviously, they want more stories and they want to know more about these characters, but they don't want you to break them. They don't want you to do anything crazy and fundamentally change them to a point where they don't resemble what that character should be. It's almost like someone handing you a box of toys and saying, well, you know, you can take these toys out of the box and you can play with them for a little while, but you can't get your dirty fingerprints on them, and you can't break the toys, and you have to put the toys back in the box at the end of the day. And I've heard some writers say that they feel that that's a straitjacket, that, you know, it's creatively bereft. It's, you know, how can you do anything interesting with those characters if you're not allowed to make them fundamentally grow and change? And I think the exact opposite. I think it is a really fascinating thing to do with an existing character, because prose does the one thing that television and film can't really do, and that's give you an internal viewpoint. So if you're reading a Star Trek novel and there's, you know, Captain Kirk is having a scene there, you know, if you watch the TV show, you'll get one impression from that from William Shatner's acting. But, you know, you read a book and you're getting an internal viewpoint from that character and you're understanding what's going on inside their head. And I think that gives you a way to open out that narrative and explore those characters in unique and interesting ways. And as somebody who has a lot of love for those franchises, for me it's kind of like coming home. You know, it's like visiting the house of a friend. Star Trek is a TV show I grew up watching. It's given me years of entertainment, lots of great fun over the years. So when someone came to me and said, well, would you like to tell a story in this world? Would you like to add a little piece to this great patchwork of narrative that is the Star Trek mythos? Absolutely. You know, I leapt at the chance. Mm. And I'm very pleased to have been able to contribute something to that ongoing world.
In some ways, I should think that's every young man's dream come true.
Yes, indeed. Definitely, if you're a Star Trek fan, I would say so.
For those of you just joining us, I'm pleased to be speaking on this portion of the morning show with best-selling author James Swallow. We are talking today about his latest work, which is a thriller, a novel called Nomad. Mr. Swallow, it is so interesting to think about the genre of the thriller and to try to imagine just what it is that comprises a great thriller, and you've certainly written one with Nomad. It maybe in some ways slightly echoes the question I just asked about the tie-in novel with pre-existent franchises. The fact that a thriller seems like a genre in which there is a very general sort of format or scenario that is common to so many of them. And you as the novelist face the intriguing challenge of bringing something fresh and interesting to that genre, which has been explored hundreds if not thousands of times by now. What intrigues you about this genre and in particular that particular point about trying to say something fresh in such a familiar format?
In a way, I'm kind of cheating a little bit because I think the books that I'm writing kind of have one foot in the future and the present, you know, trying to create that fresh new thing that you're saying about, but it also has kind of one foot in the past. Because for me, as a reader of thrillers, the kind of books that always excited and thrilled me were what we would think of probably as the kind of 70s, 80s airport thriller, blockbuster thriller novels. And I just loved those books, absolutely devoured them. And to this day, I cannot walk past a second-hand bookstore without going in and coming out with an armful of these, you know, dog-eared techno-thriller novels. And so when I decided that I was going to write a thriller novel, I wanted to write that style of thriller. I wanted to write something that has that kind of high-speed, low-drag action-adventure that has these characters in this dark, compelling espionage world. I wanted to bring all that stuff together, but then also try and focus that through a modern lens, a kind of, you know, post-WikiLeaks, post-Edward Snowden, 21st century techno-thriller, to try and do all of the stuff in those books that I love so much, but update it a little bit and give it just a little bit of a spin.
I think if there is anything that is noteworthy above all else in this novel, it is the character of Mark Dane. And indeed, it's also important to say that you seem like a writer that cares a lot about character, and that it isn't enough to just concoct scarier and scarier scenarios with bigger and bigger explosions and more plot twists, but that your novels, including Nomad, are inhabited by really interesting people. And I can't remember the last time I encountered a character in a thriller quite as intriguing as Mark Dane, a reluctant hero in so many different ways. Tell us more about how you created this particular character and the kinds of things you thought about in terms of giving him texture and a really vivid sense of authenticity.
I think you hit the nail on the head there when you described him as a reluctant hero. You know, when I was looking at the other thriller books that were around in the marketplace at the time when I was thinking about writing this book, what I kept coming across was these flawless, perfect, amazingly super competent heroes. And I'm not saying that those guys are not fun to read, because, you know, who doesn't like to see a character who can kind of walk into the room and immediately command everybody's attention? But there are a million of those guys. And I was thinking to myself, what do I want to do to make my thriller different? I don't want to tell a story about that kind of guy, because there are other people already doing that. So how can I do it in a way that is a little more different? And so I looked at the tropes of the thriller and the spy action story, and, you know, quite often we will see that sort of scene where you have the guy who is the trigger puller, the door kicker, going into the room and beating up the bad guys. And then there's a guy outside in the van. There's always a guy in the van, you know, tapping away on the keyboard, on the radio, telling the hero what to do and where to go. And immediately I thought, well, what if the guy in the van has to do the other guy's job? And that was the kind of the seed of the Mark Dane character. He is the guy in the van who finds himself forced into becoming the trigger puller and the door kicker. He doesn't have a chance. He has everything taken away from him. He gets thrown into this situation where he's on the run, and he has to step up and become what we would think of as our traditional action hero. So he is reluctantly forced into this, and he is very much pushed out of his comfort zone. And I really like the idea of that, of a guy who does not immediately have the solution to every problem, and he has to, you know, come up with stuff on the fly and be, you know, deal with his own ingenuity, I guess, to sort of figure out the way around things. He's somebody who has to run to keep up. He has someone who has to earn every victory he gets. He doesn't just kind of slide through with a quip, and you know, he's not fast with his fists or great with his gun. You know, he has to kind of work a little harder to save the day. And I think at the end, hopefully readers will feel a character like that is a little bit more human, a little bit more realistic.
Right. The action comes fast and furiously in this novel, and I don't think it's taking too much away to explain that he is part of an intriguing unit of a fictional group called MI6, and that and Mark Dane's particular team, codenamed Nomad, is ambushed, and all but Mark Dane are killed, and most of the novel springs out of that. Who is responsible for this, and what can Mark Dane do about it when he realizes that he doesn't know who he can trust? What did you think about when you created this backdrop, which, at least for the most part, is fictional, features fictional entities, and yet feels really quite connected to the real world in which we are all living right now?
Well, first, I have to just correct you. The MI6 is actually a real organization. That's the British External Security Force. But the organization that Mark is part of, the operations team Nomad, that is fictional.
Right.
That's okay. So it's kind of what I tried to do there is a lot of what I've done with the book is I've tried to marry real-world, truthful things with fictional stuff that feels like they synchronize together. So I try to create a little bit of the real from one hand and a little bit of the unreal from the other to try and create the core of my story. But in terms of inventing that, you know, what I did is I went back to real information about how MI6 actually operates, about what kind of work they do in the real world. And I just kind of turned the dial up a little bit, you know, pushed the speed a little bit further forward to make things just that little bit more exciting and more action-packed. And I think that's kind of the core to what this story is to take something real and just say, well, what would happen if it was just pushed that little bit further, and if things became, you know, the stakes are raised a little higher, the danger is a lot more dangerous.
Right. And of course, because Mark Dane believes that somebody within MI6 betrayed them, that is why his team was wiped out. He finds himself unable to turn to anybody that he would normally turn to for assistance and guidance. He has to go outside to kind of another level of anti-terrorism organization that, in a sense, operates beyond the shadows. And that's really an interesting world for this story to inhabit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the era of the real world we live in now, is we're reaching a point where extra-governmental organizations are getting to the point where, you know, when we're talking about, like, corporations here and larger non-governmental actors are developing to the stage where they have as much power as national governments. And so I wanted to touch on that idea about what would it be like if an organization that doesn't have an allegiance to any flag has only an allegiance to their particular set of codes. What if that organization is out in the world writing wrongs, doing things by their own rule book? You know, how would that be? What would it be like to be part of that? How would an organization like that exist? You know, kind of, if you imagine basically vigilantes, but on a global scale. Imagine an organization like that out there writing wrongs, but also flouting, you know, laws and getting in the way of governmental organizations. I think that is an interesting basis for an interesting vehicle for which to explore these kind of stories.
Absolutely. And of course, your main protagonist, Mark Dane, at many points along the way wonders what he's gotten himself into. And these people that, to some extent, feel like allies and people he needs their help. And yet, sometimes it's help that feels almost more dangerous than the original threat he's trying to evade. I mean, you've really created a frightening scenario for this character, and I think it's a thrilling ride because of it. And he also seems like a character we want to hear more from. Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Mark is very much a guy who is kind of just slightly in over his head, and that's something I've tried to keep with all the stories that I tell, is that he, as I said before, he has to run to keep up, so things don't come easy to him. But of course, because he's a hero, he's the kind of guy who will step up when he sees a problem, when he sees something bad is happening. He's not the kind of person who can sit on the sidelines. And I think the events of Nomad are what crystallize his character and make him become the hero that he could always be. And then once that story is told, that opens the gates for him to appear in more fictional stories. And so following the plot of Nomad, currently there are three novels in the series. The next one is Exile, which involves Mark on the trail of a rogue suitcase nuclear device. And then there is Ghost, which has just been released here in the UK. And that is to do with black hat hackers, which is a very kind of timely thing right now about people talking about hacking and using social media kind of to cause trouble and those kind of things. And at the moment, I'm currently working on the fourth novel in the series, which will be released in the UK next year.
Wow. In the meantime, for readers here in the United States, Nomad is on bookshelves now. Nomad, published by Forge, and the author, James Swallow. James Swallow, thank you so much, and congratulations on yet another superb book.
Thank you so much.
The studios of WGTD will be closed tomorrow because of the Juneteenth holiday. We will be back with a morning show broadcast on Friday from the archives, the author of a book called Transgender History, which we replay in honor of Pride Month. By the way, you can still hear the morning show tomorrow if you access the podcast version of the program. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, weather permitting, the Kenosha Pops Concert Band begins its summer season of Wednesday night concerts in the Panoia Park Bandshell tonight at 7 o'clock. Again, weather permitting, the band will be playing tonight under the direction of Craig Gall and Kathy Ripley. Admission is free. The forecast is for variable cloudiness today and rain, with possibly some locally heavy rainfall this afternoon. A high today of 73 degrees, so much cooler than yesterday. The forecast is for a 70% chance of rain tonight with a low of 62, sunshine tomorrow, and we warm to 83 with warmer weather expected over the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.